Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The NLCS. Now, remember I said yesterday, if you had to sum up Bills-Titans in one single image, it had to be Derrick Henry and that stiff arm of Josh Norman. So, if you had to sum up Game 3 of the NLCS in a single image, imagine like a Derrick Henry stiff arm on Josh Norman times 15. That's how bad that was. LA, 11. Atlanta, nothing. But that was not the final score. That was the score after the top half of the first inning. So if you were one of those people, because the game got an early start, and maybe you flipped it on, or maybe you reached for your phone, and you saw that score, especially if you're a Dodger fan, 11-0 after half inning. You had to be thinking, dang, that can't be right. Well, that was right. That's how that went. That was not the final score. So to the question of whether or not the Dodgers' bats had woke up at the end of Game 2, the answer was yes. Hell yes.
Hell yes!
Mookie Betts started things off with an infield single. Well, actually, he started things off with an out that was ruled a hit on review because he just beat the throw. You got to keep that in mind. That's a really critical point right there, which I will get back to. Corey Seager follows that up with an RBI double. Nice start. Get something on the board early on. But then Justin Turner and Max Muncy grounded out. So that kind of was a buzzkill for the Dodgers, right? You want to jump on these guys early on, especially when you're down 2-0. For a moment, it looked like it was going to be a mug job, but then suddenly Braves starting pitcher Kyle Wright has got a chance to work out and limit the damage. You know, get that last out and then let your bats go to work. Except he was not able to get that last out. Because then Will Smith doubled to left, driving in Seager. Then Cody Bellinger walked, and then Jock Peterson stepped in.
Well, how big is this inning going to be? Right now, that's up to Kyle Wright and Jock Peterson.
Here's a shot into left center field. Back at the wall. It's gone. What a start for the Dodgers. Jock Peterson goes deep. And it's a five-run first inning, thanks now to a three-run shot by Peterson.
That was key, right? Fox. And Joe Buck said it before, like, how big of an inning is this going to be? It'll be up to Wright, Gonzo. 5-0 Dodgers. Down 2-0. Now, that's the start they had to have. That's the start that they had to have, and that start was not even complete because Edwin Rios was up next.
All of this starting on that close play at first. Here is a shot to center by Rios. Back at the wall. That is gone. Wow. 6-0. Dodgers on top. And have they been waiting for this type of outburst?
6-0. You had to feel pretty good about that. Dodgers money line bet, right? Had to feel pretty good about that start. 6-0. Chris Taylor walks. Wright gets yanked from the game after only 2/3 of an inning. That's not good. In fact, if you don't make it out of the first inning of your start, that's below not good.
Below not good.
Mookie Betts comes up for his second at bat in the first inning. So now they've battered around. Betts gets a walk. Then Corey Seager comes up again.
Seager bangs one to center field. That's going to drop in for a base hit. Taylor comes in to score, and Betts slides in safely at third. The Dodgers lead it 7-0, and we're not finished with the first.
No, definitely not. Justin Turner, who was the first out of the inning, comes right back. He gets hit by a pitch. So guys are getting their second at-bats of the first inning, and they're making the most of them. As an example, Max Muncy. Muncy made the second out of the inning. Muncy was not about to be the guy who made two of the three outs in the greatest postseason inning ever. Hell no, Muncy was not. So instead, he did this.
The bases are loaded, and the batter is Max Muncy with two out here in the first inning.
Here's a fly ball into right center field. Back at the wall. It is gone. Grand slam. And the first inning is historic. 11 runs on the board for the Dodgers as they are just dropping bombs here in the first inning.
Historic and insane. And the insanity finally ended when Will Smith struck out looking. But by that point, that game was already over. Like, Atlanta had not even picked up the bat yet, and the game was already over. Even the arsonists in the L.A. bullpen could not blow an 11-0 lead. Hell, I wouldn't have been surprised if Dave Roberts started to make defensive substitutions in the bottom half of the first. And yet, they still weren't done. There was still more. There was Cody Bellinger in the second.
Could have been called.
Here's one into right. Back at the wall. It is gone off the bat of Bellinger. Home run number 4 on the night for the Dodgers. And Bellinger is finding that stroke.
All of that, and we're still in the second inning. And then Corey Seager had to do this in the third.
Corey Seager, who's 2 for 2, 3-run homer and an RBI double and a run scored in his last 2 plate appearances last night. And he just touches one off. Wow. In a Dodger lineup that is suddenly absolutely red hot, he is the hottest one.
All right, so never seen anything like that, because nothing like that had ever happened before. 11-0 at the end of the top half of the first, an MLB record for most runs in a postseason inning. 10 of those runs came with 2 outs, which is insane and clutch. And I go back to that first point. Had Betts not beaten that ball out, had he not hustled down to first the way he did, that inning is over before it even starts. Then the game is completely different, and we might be talking about a completely different series. But he beat the throw. Then he scored, and then the route was on. Do not overlook what that hustle play meant. What that meant for that game, what that might mean for the entire year. Jock Peterson knows.
Some reason that just lit a match in everyone, and we were excited and just ran with that momentum.
So they didn't just put up 15 in the first 3 innings. They're also the first team in postseason history with 5 home runs in the first 3 innings. That was a beatdown to end all beatdowns. Atlanta wandered out into traffic last night, and they got dragged by an 18-wheeler. After having their offense kept under wraps for the first 15 innings of that series, suddenly a fight breaks out at the bat rack. Everybody wanted to get a shot during that 15-3 win. So for the Dodgers, what that was the ultimate get-right game. Of course, the question is, does that carry over to tonight? Because that was the question after that Game 2 loss. Did that big 9th inning carry over to Game 3? It did. What about last night? Does that carry over to tonight and the rest of the series? Like, they're still down 2-1. And while tonight is not an elimination game, I'm going to argue that for LA, it's a must-win game. You don't want to fall behind these guys 3-1. It's not an elimination game, but to me, it is a must-win game. Just so all you Dodger honks know, this is not an easy hill to climb. It's been 35 years since a team won the NLCS after losing the first 2 games. 35 years. But if you're going to do it, there are worse ways to do it than to beat your opponent into submission in Game 3 and then send Clayton Kershaw out to the bump for Game 4. Especially when it's Kershaw going up against Bryce Wilson, who has pitched less than 43 innings in his entire MLB career and is coming in after not pitching for a half a month. LA Bats woke up late on Tuesday night. They were live as hell last night, and they need to stay there tonight. In other words, not dead, can't quit. Not dead, can't quit. Lose tonight, and they're probably dead. But if Kershaw does his job, that's going to go a long way towards changing his postseason narrative, and it could save the Dodgers' entire season. And then who knows how many jobs, too. Not dead, can't quit. If you're a business owner, you do not need me to tell you that running a business is rough. You know this, but you might be making it tougher on yourself than necessary. Do not let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down any longer. It is time for you to upgrade to NetSuite. Listen to me. Stop paying for multiple systems that do not give you the information that you need when you need it. Man, ditch the spreadsheets and all that old software that you've outgrown that is so outdated. Upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, your HR, your inventory, your e-commerce, and everything you need all in one place instantaneously. So whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, you need to save time and and money, and you can do so with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies that are using and loving NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Rome. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Rome, netsuite.com/ROME. We are joined by Hoosiers head coach Tom Allen. Tom, nice to have you back. How are you?
Great to be back on your show. I'm doing awesome.
Good, good. Good to have you back. Now, you and I last spoke in November when you were in the middle of a great season. Obviously, so much has happened in the world since then. What was the offseason like for both you and the team?
Well, very unique, that's for sure. You know, started off normal and got through 8 weeks of off-season training, and then obviously spring ball started, got into 4 days, and that's when everything changed. So it's been very segmented. That's been the biggest difference. You know, guys been apart way more than normal. But once we got back together, thought that was really good. As we brought guys back systematically, had a great plan for that, but then we got paused a couple times and then started the season and got paused again. And so that part's been the challenging, the starting and stopping and just trying to get your guys mentally and physically ready. But it's we're all in the same boat. Everybody's been fighting the same battle, so we're just trying to get ready for game day.
Right. We're talking to Indiana head football coach Tom Allen. Now, I know you're focused on the here and now, but at the same time, as you told The Athletic, there was a period of time after last season where, as good as last season was, you were thinking about how much better it could have even have been, about how you could have won that bowl game, about the losses to Michigan State and Penn State. What kind of thoughts were you having at that time?
Well, you know, you just go back and you evaluate. You know, you know the history of the program and how close we were to winning an unprecedented amount of games here, you know, to have so many close games. Yeah, we won some close games for sure, so you got to go back, and that balances it out as well. But you look at the, you know, I seem to look at the ones, you know, the Michigan State game that we didn't finish, and then you mentioned the bowl game was one that I just really, you know, it just frustrates the way you finish. And so you go back and you try and reevaluate what do you do to be able to correct those opportunities and create change. And so we made a video about it. You know, go back and just talking about, you know, being so close and having one more and having that be the case no more. And had the guys realize in those three key games that we didn't finish on, and then showed them the three games where we did finish, you know, to create the 8 wins in the regular season that hadn't happened in a long time. So you got to be able to go back and reflect and to just keep building, because I believe the best is yet to come for Indiana football.
We're talking to Tom Allen. You know, that's really interesting to me. Like, when you talk about building, when you're building a program the way you're building that program, and you have a season like the one you had last year, you would think that coming into the spring, you'd want to build on that momentum. But then, of course, the pandemic sets in and everything changes. So I'm curious, when you're building something the way you are and you've got that momentum, and then it stops suddenly and you can't see everybody face-to-face, how do you maintain that? How do you continue with that build?
Yeah, it is, Trav. It's a great question. You know, but I tell you what I told our team was this: we don't blink. You know, those things that happen, we had no control. We were out there practicing away, and all of a sudden spring ball gets canceled. You don't blink. Then they cancel classes. We don't blink. Then we end up having a summer that was basically completely canceled for a while. We don't blink. Then we come back to fall camp, and we have to do everything a different way. We've been doing everything by Zoom, and we just don't get flustered by the things we can't control. And that's a part of our program philosophy. It's how we kind of got to this point and playing such a tough schedule every single year, being in Big Ten East and being in the situation we're in here. We just don't – it's that don't blink mindset. And so we try to let your core values and who you are, the accountability, toughness, and love that I believe in so much, you want that to come shining through. And LEO, which I believe in, you know, with so much passion about, that's how you build a great team. So those core things that we believe in and those things you have as your foundation of your program, they help you through these tough times.
I like that. Indiana head football coach Tom Allen is joining us. So, of course, you're not going to ease into anything, right? You've got number 9 Penn State right out of the gate. You said the other day that when you think about their talent, quote, to me, those are the kind of things that make me not sleep at night and make me pretty restless. That's been growing as kickoff gets closer. Hey, listen, nobody wants to lose sleep, right? But in a way, do you find that you appreciate that lack of sleep and worrying about an opponent in ways that maybe you did not appreciate that before?
Well, there's no question, you know, when things are taken away from you and just the fact that we, you know, thought we may not even have a season, you're very, very excited about those sleepless nights that the season is going to create for you. So we embrace it. Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, you play teams like a caliber of a Penn State. Every mistake you make can be a big play in special teams, on defense, on offense. And so, yeah, that's definitely what keeps you up at night. But, yeah, you're right. It's all about perspective. And I think the whole country's realized that when things are taken away from you, you realize how blessed we are to have what we have. So we're going to take every moment, enjoy it, and take full advantage of it.
We're talking Indiana football. The head coach, Tom Allen, is joining us. You know, I mentioned some of the numbers, what they were like before you arrived and what they've been like since you've been there. And then you've got the recruitment of Taiwan Mullen, who wrote down numbers on a sheet of paper. What was that moment like for you, and what did that tell you about him?
Well, I tell you what, it made me choke up, man. I got emotional. I knew we had the right guy, but I tell you, man, what about that kind of mindset? You know, and when I got here, I talked about, you know, changing the way this program is perceived. And, with, you know, before there's a reality, there's a mentality. I believe in that very strongly and say it all the time to our players. And he's a guy that bought in, you know, and he did his research, you know, the 52-26-10, the thing that really was such a big part of me saying, hey, this is our history. You know, think about the history and in your past. Those things aren't predictive unless you don't make changes. And so, and I wanted to make changes, and I wanted to be able to realize, hey, this is where we are. This is where we want to be. And he's a young man that wants to help us get there. So I'm looking to this country for guys like Taiwan Mullen to say, coach, I believe in what you're building there. I want to be a part of it. I want to be a guy that comes here and makes those history-changing plays.
Yeah, like, right? Like, what's it mean to you to hear that from a player? Because he's not the only one. You've recruited players that could have gone elsewhere. It's one thing for these guys to have other opportunities. It's one thing for these guys to come in and buy in, but it's another for them to say, I want to be here and I want to change the culture. I want people to look back on what we did and how we set this up for the others to come after us. What's it mean when you have more than one guy like that in the locker room? In fact, you've got a bunch of guys like that.
We do. It means a whole lot, you know, and I always tell our guys, you know, it's not what I believe, it's what do you believe? Because I'm not out there making plays, you know, it's what do you believe, how are you going to prepare, you know, what are you willing to do to get what you want? And to have multiple guys on this football team that have chosen to come to Indiana when they could have gone other places and maybe could have gone to a place that was more established, per se. But I love those guys that got that chip on their shoulder and something to prove. And he wanted to come here and be a part of the build. And he and many, many others. And Michael Penix is a guy that could have gone to a lot of other places. You know, but he chose to come here. He wanted to be a part of the history-changing opportunity that this place gave him. And that excites me. Like you said, those guys are the key. It's all about players. This is a player-driven situation. We're relationship-driven as a staff, and I love these guys. It just means so much to me that they believe in what we're doing here, and they want to be a part of it.
So finally, Tom, you've got that winning season from last year, so that box is checked. You are very close to getting that bowl win. I know how badly you wanted that one and how you're in pursuit of that. What does the next step in this program look like to you?
Well, you know, I've talked about it with our team, and that is beating top 25 teams. You know, we've been so close, and we're blessed to have the chance to play a bunch of them every year. And this year's no different. And so the opportunity to put ourselves in those positions to be able to finish those games, we've shown we can compete in those games, but finish them is the next step. And being able to allow us. And once you start doing that, and those things, everything else just kind of falls into place. So to me, that's the mindset. That's the expectation. And as you mentioned, that bowl game win is something that means a whole lot to this program, to our fan base, and to our players. So that's a huge next step for us as well.
SEC ball. Now, the SEC in and of itself has had itself a week now. There was that announcement earlier in the week of positive COVID tests at Vanderbilt, the forced postponement of the Vandy-Missouri game. Then there was the news from Lane Kiffin that his team was dealing with a bunch of positive tests as well. Then you had the news that Florida had 21 positive tests among its players, and that forced the postponement of Florida LSU. And yes, those tests at Florida and the postponement of that game were quite a plot twist, given that Dan Mullen had been calling for the fans to, quote, pack the swamp a few days prior. He walked that back yesterday. You think? He walked that back. And walking it back was the right call. I mean, I understand the enthusiasm and wanting to have your crowd behind you. But how about we don't pack anything during a pandemic? As if the postponement of two SEC games were not enough. Then the most shocking news of all. Alabama announced that Nick Saban and athletic director Greg Byrne had tested positive for COVID. Saban had this to say in the form of a statement.
But I was informed early this afternoon that I had a positive test for COVID-19 on a PCR test At this point, I'm completely asymptomatic, feel fine. Our medical officials have told me as long as I remain asymptomatic, I will have a daily PCR testing per SEC protocol to confirm the initial positive.
That's Nick Saban. So at this point, I mean, you have to say no positive COVID should be considered a surprise at all. Again, we're talking about a virus. We're talking about a pandemic. And if there is no bubble, there are going to be positive tests. And there will be cancellations. And this is to be expected. Yet for some reason, Nick Saban's positive test is like a surprise. I mean, I guess it shouldn't be, but it is. We've got to be talking about the most protected human being in the state of Alabama, right? And for him to swab positive right now, just days before facing Georgia in the biggest game of the year, man, that seems weird to me. Even at this time, even with this virus, even during a pandemic, I don't know. It's almost like he's Teflon, like not Saban. How can Nick Saban get it or anything? But then the fact is, it's not crazy, right? The crazy part was thinking that the SEC was not going to have positive tests, that the SEC would not postpone games, that it was not going to have coaches missing games, because Saban is going to miss that game Saturday. When he met with the media via Zoom, he said that he had been careful, but last week's road trip in Oxford, Mississippi might have been where he picked it up.
I think as soon as you travel, you get exposed to a lot more things and a lot more people.
Right. There is something to that. Right. Travel is when you break your routine. Travel is when you break your personal bubble. Travel is when you come in contact with much more people. Florida's spike in positive tests came, for instance, after their trip to Texas A&M. But Saban also tried to make the point. Even though this is coming just days before a massive game against another one of his former assistants, he really has not changed up much at all.
I can do absolutely everything here. I'll have the same exact routine. You know, the first thing I do on Thursday morning is watch the defensive practice with the defense. Then we do 2-minute and 2-point plays. Then I watch what we did against each other with the offense. Then I watch the offensive practice and I watch special teams. Then I usually do a little write-up for 2-minute and 2-point plays for the team. I'll do all those things exactly like I always do it.
So I see this guy working. He wants to make sure that nothing changes, or as close to nothing as possible. He even went into detail about how he was handling guys who made mistakes in practice, even if he was not physically there for the practice.
I watched practice today. I had the manager had a phone. If I wanted to play repeated, I said, repeat that play. So-and-so messed up. So I didn't leave the country or anything. I'm just right down the street, and we have this technology. So we're going to do the best we can to keep everything normal.
That's pretty good. I didn't leave the country. Nick Saban watching practice via video conference and picking up the phone when he's pissed about a bad rep is a pretty remarkable look. Not quite as insane as, for instance, Hugh Freeze coaching from a hospital bed in a booth in a press box, but this is still pretty good. Like, I know everybody is kind of numb to this thing right now, but just go back 12 months. Go back 12 months. Go back to last season. What if I told you that Nick Saban would not be on the sideline for the biggest game of the year? What if I told you that he was going to monitor practice and get into guys via Zoom? Would you have even known what Zoom was? What if I told you that for the biggest regular season game of the year, that Saban was going to be at home and Steve Sarkisian was going to lead the Crimson Tide? Saban also talked about the question of whether or not he will be able to communicate directly with his coaches during that game. You know, can he have a Zoom window up? Can he have a G-chat with them? Can he send them some DMs? Can he patch directly into his headsets or their headsets? He's not sure. Saban said, we'll have to figure it out.
We'll have to research and sort of figure that one out.
I got you covered, Nick. You don't have to do anything of the sort. I've already got your answer, and the answer is no. No, you cannot. Let me read from the 2020 NCAA football play interpretations. Quote, Rule 1411B is very specific and allows only voice communication between the press box and the team area. Therefore, a coach could not call into the press box or sideline for anything related to coaching purposes. End of quote. So what that means is Sark and company are on their own for the biggest game of the regular season. Saban is going to be back home in quarantine, shoveling Little Debbie oatmeal cream pies into his pie hole. We call that nervous pie holing. And yes, can you imagine Saban? Saban and the AD swab positive, but nobody else did? None of the players? None of the staffers? Only Saban and the AD. Nobody else, at least not yet. So, if that holds, we've got ourselves a ball game. A game that the greatest coach in the history of the sport has to watch from home and can't coach from home. He has to watch from home because, well, 2020, the wackest year of them all. Hey, Bama fan, get ready!
Get ready!
Because it's going to be fun.
Right on, baby. Let's go!
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake this time or eat a bar or grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty, it's tender, it's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. And it goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? My guest is Bruce Feldman. Bruce, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So, Bruce, normally when you and I are talking 2 days before number three Georgia going up against number two Alabama, we'd be all about that matchup, which I'll get to in a minute, but obviously there is bigger news. What was your reaction, Bruce, to the news that Nick Saban tested positive for COVID?
You know, it's a little surreal, Jim. He's certainly not the first college football coach who has tested positive, but he's the biggest coach and the biggest name in college football. It's also when word got out, it wasn't just him. It was also the Alabama AD, Greg Byrne, who had also tested positive. Now, Saban, I was on a call with him probably an hour after that, and he had explained he has no symptoms at this point, and it's just, you know, he's one of those guys where whenever you've seen him, he's been very proactive in terms of the messaging. He's seemingly always had a mask on where, you know, you've seen plenty of highlights of coaches during games where they haven't, or it looks like it's, you know, down around their neck or whatever. They're wearing it like a satchel or something. He's not been that way. So, you know, when we talked to him after yesterday, one of the things that I think he is very mindful of is just, hey, you know what? The virus is basically all around us, and it's something where you have to be extra careful. And I think fortunately for Alabama, they're one of the few programs right now who is testing daily. So they caught this. Some other programs are testing three times a week. Some other programs are only testing one day a week. And so what has happened quite a bit has been this virus has spread pretty quickly through some of these programs because either they go on a road trip and they're in a cramped visitor's locker room or they're at a team meal or whatnot. It's just that's been one of the challenges with this. So fortunately for Alabama, it appears they were able to catch it very quickly. And as soon as Saban found out he got the positive test, he went home and he actually tried to coach the practice as best he could from home.
Right. Bruce Feldman joining us. He did do that, Bruce. Now, he does make the point that he's not playing in that game, but at the same time, we know he's an enormous presence. So what do you think it's going to be like to have Alabama playing in a huge game Saturday night without Nick Saban on the sideline? How much do you think that will impact the game?
I think it's definitely going to have some impact just in terms of you're talking about the players who are so used to this guy who is such a dominating presence in everything that goes on with Alabama football. And it's really not just the players. It's this big staff they've had where he's involved in every decision. Now, you know, you can take a look. Les Miles, the coach at Kansas, another national title-winning coach, he also has tested positive for COVID. Maybe he will be back on the sidelines this week or not when they play West Virginia. Les Miles is not as hands-on the way running a football program, especially in-game, the way Nick Saban is. One of the only coaches I can think of who maybe every bit is connected to it in a lot of facets of the game is TCU's Gary Patterson. So look, what I was told by people close to Saban is that he has the utmost confidence in Steve Sarkisian, and Sarkisian has a leadership presence to him. I think he has obviously a bunch of experience from his time at Washington and some at USC in some big games, but he's certainly not Nick Saban. And so that's a significant deal, and we'll see how it plays out. Because of the NCAA rules, he is not permitted, if you're not in the building, if you're not in the stadium, if you're not in the coach's press box, you cannot really have communication, you know, from the time basically the game is going to start. So it's going to be a big adjustment, not just for the players, but for everybody on that Alabama sideline.
We're talking about that matchup on Saturday night. Bruce Feldman is joining us. And the matchup, Bruce, is really interesting on a number of different levels, but especially when you consider the two starting quarterbacks. You've got Georgia's Stetson Bennett. You've got Alabama's Mac Jones. Right now, you've got a great piece up on The Athletic about Shannon Dawson and his connection to both players. For those who do not know, who is Dawson and how is he connected to them?
Well, Dawson's actually the offensive coordinator at University of Houston. But what's fascinating is he was the first one to really buy in, at least in college coaching, to either guy. He was the one who Mac Jones had committed to as a junior when Dawson was the offensive coordinator at Kentucky. You know, Dawson had first seen him when he was in eighth grade, and the kid came up to a camp at West Virginia and threw for him. That's where Dawson worked at the time. And then after he left Kentucky, he goes to Southern Miss and he sees this 5'10 quarterback who he gets somebody, a friend sends him film of. And he just thinks, man, this guy is special. He's got some Baker Mayfield in him. Loved how he threw the ball. Loved how accurate he was. When the kid came to visit, he saw how big his hands were. He measured him. He was like, that's something I really think is important for quarterbacks. But his head coach would not offer him. So he was like, I had to try to get him to walk on. This kid grew up going to Georgia games. So when they gave him a chance to walk on, he was like, as much as I tried to tell him, Stetson Bennett, and his dad, say, hey, you know what? They're always going to have a five-star kid. You're not going to play there. And he goes, and I think you're a good player. It's going to be sad. Well, you know, eventually this kid was at one point the four-string quarterback. But for a variety of things that have happened, he got his chance to play, and he has excelled at it. And so you have these two quarterbacks, neither guy, because remember, obviously, Mac Jones, when he signed with Alabama, the other quarterback who signed that year was Tua. So it wasn't like everybody was expecting Mac Jones to be this guy going to take over the program. And then they take Bryce Young from out here, another five-star kid from modern day. I think a lot of people thought he was going to be the guy. So credit to Mac Jones, credit to Stetson Bennett, for believing in their ability enough and just staying true when a lot of other people thought it wasn't going to happen.
Bruce Feldman joining us. All right then, Bruce, who do you like on Saturday and why?
You know, before the Saban news, I picked Alabama. I think Georgia's defense has looked really good. They're talented. I think Stetson Bennett has played really well. He's got some playmaker savvy in him. But having said all that, the game's in Tuscaloosa. To me, Alabama has the best receiving core in college football. They also have Najee Harris, who's a tremendous running back. I think Alabama is much better in the skill position right now than Georgia is. I know their defense looked really shaky, and Lane Kiffin's, you know, Ole Miss offense really gave them fits. But I just think that it's a big game, even without Nick Saban. I think it's going to be really hard for Georgia to slow down this offense. I just think it's just too explosive, especially the way the run game complements those receivers who are so dynamic. I mean, Georgia's good on defense, but I don't see anybody slowing down this Alabama offense.
We're talking to Bruce Feldman. All right, Bruce, I mentioned off the very top that you've got a brand new book coming out with Ed Orgeron. It's called Flip the Script. You and Coach O go back quite a bit. When did you first meet him, and what do you remember about that?
It was actually, I had moved out to California, and this was back in the Matt Leinart, the USC days under Pete Carroll. And I was working at ESPN Magazine at the time, and they had a really good defensive line. And it was a bunch of guys who had become, you know, high-round NFL draft picks. And Orgeron was the head coach, was the defensive line coach at USC and really the recruiting coordinator. And just, you know, you hear all these amazing stories about him and just a larger-than-life character. And so I kind of connected with him there for an ESPN magazine story on that group. It was Sean Cody, Mike Patterson, Kenichi Udizi. I mean, this was a really talented group. And they were really part of the foundation of what Pete Carroll got built there at USC and ended up obviously winning national titles. And so from there, I did a book really about recruiting where it was a fly on the wall in the Ole Miss football office when he was the head coach there called Meat Market. And Jim, I'd always get asked, the book did quite well, and it was just a unique story. And he's a unique figure. And so I'd always got asked, would you ever do a sequel to Meat Market? And I just didn't think that was really possible. But then once he got the LSU job, and you'd see both from his time as the interim at USC, but even how he's had to really grow and learn from all the mistakes, not only the mistakes that he made, especially at Ole Miss, certainly the mistakes that he saw Lane make when Lane was the head coach and he was with him at USC. And just to see that evolution and to see then how they go on this remarkable run and go 15-0 and you know, they have Joe Burrow and Joe Brady and all these pieces come together. I just thought it was an amazing story. So this is basically the sequel to Meat Market.
We're talking to Bruce Feldman. It is an amazing story, and that was a great book in and of itself. Let me ask you this, Bruce, before you go. The 2017 season at LSU started with wins over BYU and Chattanooga, and then there was a blowout loss to Mississippi State, then a win over Syracuse, and then the embarrassing loss at home to Troy. What kind of an impact did that loss have on Coach O and the program?
Jim, I think what's interesting there is you sit there and you think, okay, he's won the locker room over, because you knew when he became the interim, taking over for Les Miles, how hard they played for him in 2016. But the next year, as you say, it was really rocky. And I think one thing that, you know, I kind of learned from working on this book was how different a locker room can be and a team can be from year to year. And it was fascinating to hear him talk about, there was after they lose to Troy, and he was like, you know, you kind of feel like you're on the ropes and you're, you know the pressure's mounting on you because the expectations are so high. And he told me this story where he had a former player, Duke Riley, who was a really good linebacker for him, who was a rookie with the Falcons. And the Falcons happened to be on a bye week. And so Duke Riley came back to visit the team, and Ogeron said, hey, do you want to speak to the team? And he said, let me just hang out for a little bit. So Riley spent basically the next day and a half just observing. He noticed that, you know, guys didn't pick up their trays or how they treated people in the cafeteria workers, or maybe leave some trash around or didn't hustle. All these things that he had noted. And at one point, Riley then said to him after practice, hey, I'm ready to speak. And all these players thought, hey, here's Duke Riley, the team captain, coming back. He's our guy, you know, and everything. And Duke Riley lights into this team. And Ogeron said it was probably as powerful a speech as he's ever seen of a team he's been with. And in a lot of ways, he said, Duke Riley said a lot of the stuff that at that point, if I had said the same things and called him out the way Duke did, I think I might have lost that team. Because it's just the messaging at that point of the leadership and the delicate balance, it was fascinating because they went on to get a big win at Florida on the road and were able to really build some momentum. And that really laid the foundation for what became the national title that run they went on last year.
See, that really is an amazing story in and of itself. So Bruce, finally then, like, what was his process? How exactly did Coach O go about flipping the script?
Jim, I think what's really key on that was, I mean, you're talking about a guy who, look, we all have flaws. His, I think, everyone kind of could see, and he's not, there's no poker face there, a big emotional, high energy guy. But also he'd come through the process of battling addiction, which, you know, he will talk a little bit about in the book. I mean, he's now 20 years sober, but I think the lessons that come with that and the realization of you got to really have an honest, hard look at yourself and your flaws. And yeah, there could be other things that could be, you know, going on around you that you may think are less than ideal, but you got to start with yourself. And I think because of that, he has really been able to evolve in ways that a lot of coaches, especially when they get into their 50s, just they're kind of too set in their ways and too stubborn. And I think because he's always evolved, he's found ways to be very innovative. And I think a lot of times we think of innovators in football as Lincoln Riley as an X and O's guy, or you know, what Bill Belichick may do or certain guys, you know, just from a scheme standpoint. I think where he's been very innovative in the ways he gets the team ready for Saturday. And so we go into a lot of detail in the book on certain things that he's done where he's like, you know, I know it's always been done that way, but I'm not doing it that way because I know my team and I know what I think works best. And I think what's helped him is to have the trust of the team. And look, last year he had a unique dynamic because he had, it was like having a player coach to have Joe Burrow out there because they had such a bond. And I think that gave him so much more of a trust factor. And so I think that was kind of why they went on this magical run. And I think all that stuff kind of comes from knowing who you are and knowing, you know, having the trust in not just what you're doing, but what everyone else is around you. And again, I think that comes from the unique perspective of just having to be so brutally honest with yourself the way he's had to be.
Surprise, surprise, mother bleeper, the king is back.
Surprise, surprise, mother the king is back.
Except it's been a minute or two since the king has been the king. So do we have a legit Conor McGregor fight? A legit Conor McGregor UFC bout? It would appear so. Like a real fight. An actual MMA fister. And not some bleep around boxing match against some former legendary boxer past his prime. Or some exhibition that was made up for Conor with some rules to benefit Conor. No, I'm talking about an actual UFC sanctioned fight where fist and foot and elbow and everything else are going to be applied to each other's faces and heads. In what appears to be a response to Dana White telling ESPN's Brett Okamoto that he could not make a fight happen for Conor this year. And that if Conor wanted to fight, it was going to have to be in early 2021. And probably against Dustin Poirier. Essentially, Conor, if you want that fight, take it or leave it. And Conor apparently wants the fight. Conor tweeted yesterday, quote, "I accept. January 23rd is on. My goal is to see this fight take place in Cowboy Stadium. Proper style. Jerry Jones is a friend, and the stadium can hold our crowd. I will be ready for Texas, and Texas will be ready for my fans. Then Manny." Hashtag McGregor Sports and Entertainment. All right, so Conor apparently is going to take this fight. Reportedly, there's not paper on the fight yet, but that's a verbal agreement. So apparently he's not as bored as he was back in June when he retired again. And listen, there is a lot to unpack in that tweet. Some of that tweet I love, some of that I do not. First, in terms of the fight with Dustin, love that. Love that fight.
I love him.
I do love him.
I love him.
Stylistically, this fight can be amazing. You've got a couple of dudes with electric stand-up games who both will stand in and exchange blows at high levels. Warriors. Warriors. And yes, for those who follow the sport, you know this. And I know this as well. They did fight back in 2014. I saw what Conor did to Dustin back in 2014. But make no mistake, this is not the same time. And this is not the same guy. Dustin is a bad man. A bad dude. How bad? Check out a rundown of his last six fights. And another reason why I love the UFC. The best fight the best. Look at this guy's last six fights alone. Anthony Pettis, former UFC champ, he submitted him. Justin Gaethje, maybe the most electric fighter in the entire sport right now. Dustin iced him.
Ice.
Eddie Alvarez, classy former UFC champ. Dustin iced him.
Ice.
Max Holloway, former UFC champ and a future Hall of Famer, and Dustin beat him. For a belt, handily. Habib. Well, we know what happens against Habib. Nobody wins that fight. But Dustin's last time out, many of you saw it because that was in June when the UFC had the sports world eyes. All of the eyes were on them. A legendary brawl against Dan Hooker. A brawl where Dustin out-hearted, out-punched, and out-gutted Hooker. A war. If anybody saw that, then you would know what to expect with Dustin and Conor. So, for you, if you're wondering if this is in fact a legitimate fight for Conor, If they'll go fist to face, if that's what you're going to get, the answer is hell freaking yes. If Nate Diaz were here and I were to say, hey, Nate, man, shoot me straight. What do you think about this matchup? I can almost guarantee that Nate's response would be, and I quote, what up, Nate? I love Nate. I've never spoken to Nate, and I love Nate. Hey, Nate. All right, so that's the good part of the tweet. Like I said, there's a lot of good in that tweet. Oh, one more thing about that tweet. That's the good part. Now the annoying part of that tweet. Connor tagging that tweet with, quote, then Manny. Yeah, no thanks. For real, Connor. Outside of you, Emmanuel, and one Alvin DeLauro, nobody wants to see that fight. No one. No one. Seriously, you are way too talented to be wasting your time bleeping around in another boxing match. I mean, I know you're looking for the quick check, but are you a gladiator or a check casher now, Connor? Come on, man. Not even the so-called fanboy bitches want to see this.
You little fanboy bitch.
They don't even want to see it. They want to see Conor McGregor, the great mixed martial arts fighter, the gladiator who took that sport by storm like nobody ever had before. They want to see the guy who could talk generational smack, whose mental warfare was so mind-bleepingly next level. It could get under his opponent's skin, into their heads, and it affected how they fought when they got in the cage, how they even trained. And then you could run the most insane smack ever, and then incredibly enough, go out there and back it up. You were the biggest thing in the world, literally. One of the biggest things ever. My question is, where is that guy? What happened to that guy? Does that guy still exist? Or is that guy dead and gone? Because that guy did put $100 mil in the bank. And as Dana White has said, once you have $100 mil in your bank, you may not want to continue to do those things that put that money in the bank in the first place. You may not want to wake up every single morning, punch the clock by getting punched in the face all day long. Who wants to punch the clock?
The clock.
When punching the clock means getting punched in the face all day long. Yeah, it's one thing when you're a plumber's apprentice and you've got nothing. But when you've got 100 mil in the bank or something close to it, you may not want to roll out early in the morning, punch the clock.
The clock.
And then get punched in the face for a living. I get that. I understand that. I just want to know if you're still that guy. In other words, are you still that gladiator? Or are you a check casher? They want to see you fight Dustin, then maybe Habib, or Justin Gaethje, or Tony Ferguson, or even my guy Nate again. By the way, I would pay a lot of money to watch you fight Jorge even, but I'm not going to pay a cent to watch you box Manny Pacquiao.
Dude, no.
Hell, you couldn't pay me to watch you box Manny Pacquiao.
Dude, no.
Hey, Connor, I understand that apologizing is not your thing, but I think that maybe you need to say you're sorry to everybody to continue or for continuing to float this crap out into the world.
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely
everybody.
The double champ does what the he wants.
Yeah, but you're no longer the double champ. My man, fight Dustin if you win that fight, and that's no guarantee either. If you win that fight, move up the competition ladder, continue to reestablish yourself, challenge yourself, but whatever you do, man, just please be done with all this boxing nonsense. I'd rather watch Manny sing to his dad than the two of you try to make sweet music together in the ring.
Sometimes when we touch,
because that's not going to make anybody happy other than you, him, Alvin, and a few bankers. And Manny's dad.
Dude, no.
Even if Manny's dad did unthinkable things to the family dog. I mean, just come on. You do your thing. Let Manny do his thing. Connor, man, I mean, I'm coming from a place of respect and admiration, man. I miss you, dude. I miss you very much. I miss that guy. Max yourself out in the octagon. You're not getting any younger. And Dustin is still really dangerous. And he's not that guy that you iced in 2014. This is a good, good challenge. A great start. A great first step back to being that guy. Come on now. 1-800-636-8686. Where do you come out on this? How do you think that fight's going to go? Do you trust Connor to still be Connor? Or is that guy dead and gone and not coming back? Or do you actually want to see him fight Manny Pacquiao?
Dude, no.
I'd rather see Manny. I'd rather see and listen to Manny serenade his father. Sometimes when we touch. I remember when they tried to position that as a Father's Day gift. Manny singing to his dad, Sometimes When We Touch. Man, my father, who never laid a hand on me, if I ever did that to him back in the day, he would have gone upside my head probably with that. What the hell kind of Father's Day gift is this? If either Logan and or Jake ever rolled up on me with something like that, I'd be like, man, get the hell out of here with that. Oh, Alvin's in. Alvin is in from home. Ha, 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 boss. I'd rather talk to Elisa from customer service for an hour than watch that fight. Attaboy, Alvy. Hey, Alvy, is that an example of you punching the clock?
The clock.
With one G-chat message from your home on a Thursday. Come on, Alvin. Alvin, I know, speaking of clock, I know your alarm clock went off like 5 minutes ago, Alvin. I know it did. That's a dog. Did you get that, Alvin? That's Rit finding the dog sound. Because that's Manny's dog. Because as that terrible, terrible, terrible story goes, the old man did unthinkable things to the family dog. I'm not even going to get into that. You can look it up if you want. Ross Tucker. Ross, what's going on? How are you?
Jim, I'm fantastic. Let's go, man. Let's finish strong.
My man, that's what I'm saying. You get it. You understand. Listen, it's been such a weird, weird week, Ross. Then we had Sunday Night Football. We had Monday Night Football. We had Tuesday Night Football. And, well, not really any Thursday Night Football. Based on your experience, how much do these changes to the schedule impact the players themselves? As an example, does that explain what happened to the Bills on Tuesday night because they were in limbo?
You know what's funny, Jim? Everybody's been asking me that. I really have no idea. You know, in my 7 years, I think the only time anything like that happened was my rookie year, 2001, after September 11th. You know, we practiced Wednesday, maybe even Thursday of that week. September 11th happened on a Tuesday. And I remember Marty Schottenheimer gathering us around and telling us that all of the games that weekend had been postponed, and then they just added it to the end of the season. So, you know, it's not unprecedented to do something like that, to have an extra week at the end. I think people are forgetting that because that's what they did back then. They canceled, I think it was week two for everybody, and put it at the end, week 18. That's the only experience I've had with it, and it was the same for everybody, so it didn't really affect us all that much. I don't know how it'll affect these guys playing on a Tuesday night or a Monday or whatever. I was very surprised that the Titans were able to come out and play that well.
I was too. Ross Tucker joining us. I was too. I was really surprised by that. So you're going to be on the call, Ross, for Kansas City and Buffalo on Monday night. Having seen what you just saw from Buffalo, what are you hoping to see from the Bills this week?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because look, I'm thrilled to do the game. I actually have three games next week. I'll do that Monday night, Giants-Eagles Thursday night, Mercer and Army on CBS Sports Network, where you are on Saturday. So next week is a big week for me. And I was so pumped up for Monday night, still am, right? Undefeated Chiefs, undefeated Bills. And then they both lost. And what's interesting about it to me is, for the Chiefs, they've shown real vulnerability in three of the five games they played. I mean, Chargers game, they probably should have lost. That one went to overtime. something didn't seem quite right when they played the Patriots. They were fortunate, I think, that Brian Hoyer played as poorly as he did. And then obviously they just lost to the Raiders. Meanwhile, the Bills, I've been impressed with their resilience after the Rams came back. And then obviously when they were in Las Vegas against a pretty good Raiders team. But Tuesday night, they just seemed out of it. And it's weird that a Titans bunch that had one practice in 17 days could seem like they were more prepared, more with it for a game than a Bills bunch that had had, 9 days to prepare for the game. It's kind of bizarre, but it's almost like the Titans came out fresh, ready to go because they really hadn't done much, whereas the Bills had had almost too much time to prepare. I mean, I feel like we're so psychoanalyzing this, but that's kind of what it looked like to me. The two big things for Buffalo, Jim, they're going to have to get their corners back. I mean, no Tre'Davious White. I know Levi Wallace is out, but if they don't have their starting corners or Matt Milano at linebacker, that is tough to play against the Chiefs. And Josh Allen's going to have to stay patient. You know, the Titans came out. They played a lot of zone coverage. They weren't going to let Josh Allen drop any deep bombs on them. And we saw in the third quarter, started to get a little frustrated, and he forced it. Really the first one he had done that with all year. And the thing is, and you know this, there's a lot of people that really doubt Josh Allen based on what they've seen the first couple years. That was all they needed, Jim. All they needed was that one terrible interception to be able to, for at least the next month, say, and maybe the rest of the season, say, see, that's who he is. He's still the guy that throws dumb picks and has stupid turnovers.
No, Russ, I think you're exactly right. I think that if that's your point of view and that's what you were waiting on, then he gave you what you wanted. Now you've got something to run with for the next few weeks. That was just not a good showing at all. And you're right. On the back end, they've got some issues. Ross Tucker is joining us. Ross, I want to get your thoughts on Drew Brees. And I'm going to skip ahead of that because he's taken a lot of heat himself this year. You've made the point that he is no longer a top five quarterback, or not at this point. How good is he right now? And when you look at him, what do you see?
So I think he's still in the top half of the league. And I mentioned this on the Ross Tucker podcast. It seems like, I don't know what it is with Brees or Brady, but Jim, people can't wait to say they're over the hill. People can't wait to say they're washed or they're done. I don't know why that gives people such joy. Neither player is as good as they once were. Neither one of them is a top five quarterback in the NFL right now. And that's okay. I mean, they're both still top half of the league. You know, everybody's talking about Brees' arm. If you look over the last 5 years, they've been in the bottom five in the NFL in depth of target yards for Drew Brees. This is the way they've been playing for 5 years. And in some of those years, he's led the NFL in passing yards. This is how they play, especially when Michael Thomas is out. I still think Drew Brees is playing well. I think he's playing fine. He has just set the standard so high that unless it's like 350 yards, four touchdowns, zero picks, people are going to talk about how poorly he's playing or that he can't throw the ball. I mean, he had a nice deep throw, 41-yard touchdown pass to Jared Cook. And even if he doesn't have as strong of an arm anymore, who cares? Just show me the numbers, show what he does, show how many points his team has, how efficient they are. It's the defense, I think, that still needs to get cleaned up in New Orleans.
Ross Tucker is joining us. Now, Ross, let me ask you this. As a former player, you understand the nature of that business. You understand that as a player, what you sign up for and the inherent risk involved, you've kind of steeled yourself to that because you were in it, so you know. But as a former player, I'm curious, what kind of emotions did you have when you saw Dak Prescott get injured the way he did?
You know, it's funny that you say that, Jim. Two things I'll mention about that, right? Number one is, you know, I don't know if it's just with every year I get older or because I have kids now or whatever, but I'm still only 41. But I would say with every year I get older, serious injuries and seeing guys suffer serious injuries bothers me a little bit more. I don't know if that's every old guy listening or everybody listening out there that as you get a year older, but it just, I don't know what it is. Even watching college football and there's an injury, it just bothers me a little bit more than it did the year before and the year before that. That's number one. Number two, I still don't usually get emotional. I mean, it still doesn't affect me that much. But when I saw Dak, and I thought CBS did a terrific job you know, really showcasing the emotion. You know, Nance and Romo laid out. You could just see what was going through Dak's mind. I felt that one, man. I'm not going to lie. I felt that one. And I've said, I probably told you this before. You know, when you're a player, I never prayed before a game to win or to play well. I just, you know, when you go inside those white lines, that something devastating can happen to you. And I guess it's like that in other sports, but not really, right? I mean, if we're talking percentage chance, there's some percentage chance every time you play in a football game, you suffer an injury that can and will affect the rest of your life. I mean, you're talking to a guy that, you know, had a back surgery, and then my career ended with a herniated disc in my neck, which bruised my spinal cord. So you, and by the way, it could have been worse. It could have been worse than just bruising my spinal cord. So you're very aware of that every time you take the field. And that's really more than anything else. Every time I play, that's what I wanted more than anything else, was all 106 guys, nobody have that happen. No, nobody suffer an injury playing this game in your 20s or early 30s that affects the rest of your life. Hopefully that's not the case with Dak. Hopefully he'll come back and be the same guy. But yeah, that was pretty emotional, man.
I appreciate that response. Ross Tucker is joining us. He's appearing courtesy today of My Front Page Story. Ross, really quickly, I want your thoughts on the Browns, if you don't mind. They're 4-1 heading into Sunday's big game against Pittsburgh. But how did Baker Mayfield look to you after his injury against the Colts?
Well, I'm loving the Browns right now. I've been backing them the last couple weeks on the Even Money podcast. They've been very, very good to me. But I'm a little bit nervous this week, even though they're getting the points from the Steelers. I'm nervous because of what I saw from Baker at the end of that game. First of all, you know, Greg Cosell told me today that on the Ross Tucker podcast that he doesn't think Baker's playing that well. But that's not even my point, Jim. My point is, after he landed on his right side, his shoulder and his ribs, go back and watch. I think he only threw two or three more times after that. But every time he did, he was wincing, and you could see it on his face. I mean, I expect him to play, and maybe it's something with his shoulder that he can get shot up, or his ribs. All they've said so far is ribs. I suspect, just based on the pain he showed, that it might be shoulder as well. At any rate, it's hard to imagine that he'll be able to go out there and play as effectively. I mean, he wasn't even throwing the ball deep down the field, Jim. It were little underneath throws. And afterwards, you could just see it was really, really bothering him. So no matter how they medicate it, it's hard to imagine he's 100% on Sunday. And oh, by the way, they're playing T.J. Watt and Stephon Tuitt and Cam Hayward and Bud Dupree. Probably the wrong team to play if you're hurting like Baker clearly is.
Hey, Russ, I got about 60 seconds. You mentioned this concept or notion of maybe he can get shot up. This whole thing about Tyrod Taylor, you talk about bad luck. I mean, these things will happen, can happen. What do you think when you hear that he was willing to take the spike to get ready to play only to end up with a punctured lung because of an accidental issue with a doctor?
I think it's a shame, but it's not the first time I heard it. I have a friend of mine whose son played Big Ten football, and I was watching the game, and he didn't play. He was the leading rusher, didn't play. Same thing. He was a freshman. He was 18 years old, freshman in college, had some type of rib issue. Went to get it shot up, boom, popped his lung, collapsed lung, punctured lung, didn't play. So it's not it's uncommon, but it's not a 0% or 1% or either. There's some ratio where that happens. You wouldn't think that would happen at the NFL level, but you never know who these teams have at times doing some of these injections. That's a whole other topic for another day.
Good night now!